Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View for Monday evening, November 7th. This is your host, PK, and I am conducting a pre-recorded interview for this evening. As always, I'd like to thank the guys in the office, the suits at bbsradio.com, for helping to preserve and protect free speech through alternative media. And this is why I like alternative media in this case, because there is no corporate Zionist pro-Israel slant on things. We have free speech here, speak our minds, and to advocate the truth as we see it. I have always been a person who was not one to demonize Islam. I know it was fashionable, especially after 9/11. So that is something that I never really took part in, because I didn't buy into the whole scam. And tonight I'm interviewing a person who will really help fill us in more further on this. I am interviewing Kevin Barrett, who's a former university lecturer, and he's a white guy. He's a Muslim convert. He's a member of the scientific panel for the investigation of 9/11. So I have a fellow truther on my side, and he's a founding member of the Muslim Jewish Center Alliance. So it's good to know that I have someone I can really talk to who'll understand where I'm coming from, and he won't demonize me, and I won't demonize him, because it's a very sensitive topic, obviously, and with Americans. And so Kevin Barrett got his first attention when he introduced Dr. Ray Griffin in Madison, Wisconsin, on C-SPAN. And Kevin's had to endure the usual anti-American slants, or your pro-Islamic slants, and all the smears and all the distortions they make of people who, in Kevin's case and in my case, who know our stuff. But we have a Teflon-like outer sphere, and we tell it like it is. So with that, I want to welcome Kevin. Kevin, are you out there, my friend?
Hey, yeah, it's great to be with you, PK. How you doing?
Thank you. Welcome to Third Stream View.
It's good to be with you.
Would you like some tea or coffee?
Well, if you can somehow pass that through my laptop here to me, I'd be happy to take some.
Well, sorry, it's self-service here, and I'm not Obama, so I don't work miracles.
Well, I mean, I think the only miracle that Obama has worked is a miraculous con job on the American people.
That would be our Obama, who is the first black president to bomb Africa.
Right. He's done a lot of firsts, but, you know, I really thought that the world's biggest and most, you know, ridiculous con job was the obvious false flag attack on 9/11, the world's biggest botched covert operation of all time. But, you know, I think that the election of Obama as supposedly a peace candidate, a civil liberties candidate, was probably an equally monumental deception.
I knew this would happen, and I'm not just saying this. I'm not a I told you so kind of person generally, but I knew this would happen, which is why, because I do the walk, I do the talk, and I do the walk, Kevin, which is why I did not vote in 2008, because I couldn't stand McCain and I couldn't stand Obama. Obama, of course, is Bush 3 with a makeover on steroids. Obama, just like Bush, serves Wall Street, the big banks, the military-industrial congressional complex, and, of course, the all-powerful Israeli lobby. Obama is a smooth-talking lawyer who remains clueless about economics, economic history, and political economy. Therefore, Kevin, Obama may just as well be a mixed race, blue blood, skull and bones member. Amen.
Well, he might as well be. And, you know, he makes me ashamed to be an Irish American. well, you know, I've seen a lot of things in my lifetime, but I really never thought I'd see the kind of things we've seen over the past 10 years. And in some ways, Obama's betrayal of the Constitution is almost worse than Bush and Cheney's, if such a thing is possible. You know, Bush and Cheney basically announced that they were going to burn the Constitution. Cheney and Rumsfeld had been planning to burn the Constitution since way back when. You know, and the other people in Bush's cabinet, like Wolfowitz and Pearl and those guys, had been planning this 9/11 coup d'etat with Edward Luttwak and the other neoconservative fanatical cult followers of Leo Strauss, the leading Nazi philosopher's top student, University of Chicago, 1960s, according to people who were there. All these guys ever did was sit around plotting a 9/11-style coup d'etat in America. And indeed, Luttwak's dissertation was how to mount a coup d'etat in America or another Western democracy. And that was published in book form as Coup d'etat, a practical handbook. Very interesting book. It's basically a step-by-step recipe for 9/11. So those guys, the whole Bush administration, basically announced that they were going to burn the Constitution and turn the president into the front man for an absolute dictatorship. But when Obama took over and has essentially rubber-stamped all of those same policies to the point of now murdering the 16-year-old son of al-Awlaki, and there's absolutely no judicial review of this, no excuses, no reasons given, just, we just murdered this innocent 16-year-old kid, and don't ask us any questions about it. So Obama has actually normalized this gangster-style takeover of what used to be the U.S., and, you know, I just finished writing a blog piece that your listeners might be interested in on this. It's called "It Isn't the Government Anymore." And, you know, there's a great civil libertarian named Jacob Hernberger who wrote a piece about this heinous murder of this 16-year-old kid, pointing out that we've heard no reasons for it. It's completely outside the law, no due process whatsoever. And then he says the government now has the right to kill anyone it wants, American or non-American, child or adult. And my response is absolutely wrong. If it does that, it's not the government anymore. It's a mafia. It's organized crime. And, you know, organized crime is enough of a problem when they're running around dealing drugs and prostitution and killing people for hire and things like that. Yeah, that's not good, but I'm certainly not going to make it my top priority to go after them. But if an organized crime ring takes over what used to be the government and burns the Constitution, well, I think it has to be the top priority of every American citizen to take these people out by any means necessary. And I mean those words exactly the way I said them.
Well, I'm not going to wet my pants on this statement you just made, because I sort of agree. I think there's a lot of politicians and bureaucrats who should be tried and executed for treason and murder, and you know, and that would include in my list would include Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, Colin Powell, who stood there with his little bags and, you know, tried to, you know, push this war on us. But Kevin, oy vey, oy vey, you're talking about Leo Strauss as the architect of the neoconservative philosophy. Well, Leo Strauss, ironically, was Jewish. So when
but he was the leading student of the top Nazi philosopher, Carl Schmitt. Schmitt was probably the smartest Nazi, and he was the philosopher that they all looked to. And Strauss happened to be his top student. And Strauss, as Shadia Drury points out in her books on him, was far more extremist even than Schmitt. So Strauss was basically a Jewish guy who was far more extreme than the Nazis. He's like Hitler squared, but he happens to be Jewish. And he kind of took his philosophy, his racial consciousness, you know, that the Nazis had about white Germans, and I think he sort of transferred that onto a certain kind of mostly but not necessarily Jewish elite. In his case, he wasn't a believer in any religion. So
right.
For him, the equivalent of the Übermensch of the Nazis would be that elite of people who realize that there's no goodness in the world, there are no principles, no God, no nothing. So it's every man for himself. We're in a Hobbesian world. And once you realize that, then you're a member of their elite. You are completely unconstrained by any form of morality or ethics or law or anything else. and it's then your duty to rule. And you should rule by any means necessary. Violence is fine, but especially deception, because the prime method of ruling over the ordinary beasts, the goyim or the cattle who are still believing in goodness or religion or democracy or anything else, is through lying. So Strauss was the architect of ruling through the monumental big lie. When we hear the word big lie, we think of Hitler, but Strauss took it to a far more, far greater extreme. And I think 9/11, compared to the Reichstag fire, will give you a sense of just how much bigger of a Nazi these neoconservatives following Strauss are than the actual Nazis ever were.
Well, and Strauss probably contributed indirectly or directly to this, you know, also this Jewish supremacism nonsense. And a lot of these, wasn't he, I think you may have mentioned it, wasn't Pearl or Wolfowitz students of Leo Strauss?
They absolutely were, yeah. They were actually at the University of Chicago
students.
In the 60s when Luttwak, the top neoconservative military strategist of all time, and I guess Wolfowitz would vie for that title, but Luttwak sometimes is called that. He was writing his book, Coup d'Etat, A Practical Handbook, first as a dissertation and later published by, I think he actually got it published, but was Harvard University Press. It was top-tier press. And so, yeah, these guys, all they ever did was sit around with Strauss figuring out how to launch the eventual 9/11 coup d'etat, and it took them a few decades to get it all set up, but they did prepare it very carefully. And, of course, because it was so big and so complex and so heinous, the left hand couldn't know what the right hand was doing, and they made all kinds of monumental mistakes and screw-ups, left a pile of evidence to the skies that any sane person can instantly recognize. But, of course, the fact that this lie was so big and this crime was so heinous is precisely what has prevented the majority of Americans from facing the facts and doing something about it.
True, true. We'll get into 9/11. I want you to know before we do, though, that for about the last 7 or 8 years, I've gone, well, this demonization of Muslims and Islam has been going on. I've gone in the other direction. I've been studying the other tribe. I've been studying Jewish history and Zionism and Israel, and I'm very critical of Zionism. I'm not pro-Israel at all. In fact, I'm anti-Israel. I'm anti-Zionist. I'm not anti-Jewish. I laugh at those idiots who try to conflate and say that anti-Semitism equals anti-Zionism. They're two drastically different things. I've come to the conclusion that my solution for the Middle East, in my humble yet all-knowing opinion, is that we first find common ground, especially with Jews united against Zionism, the Israeli peace movement, and the Israeli civil rights groups. Because we don't hear too much from them. We don't see the protests in Israel. We don't see a lot of the anti-Zionist crowd or the Jews of Israel who oppose the occupation and the mistreatment of the Palestinians. We don't see much of that. So my studies have brought me through quite a journey through. And I'm not putting down. I acknowledge the great achievements of Jewish intellectuals or brilliant people in the arts, business, music, medicine. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a lot of the political crowd, the Zionists at the top, the Zionists who cooperated with Hitler, Theodor Herzl. And since I myself am a non-militant atheist, because Catholics make the best atheists, I have my own more cred on this, because as I am fond of saying, I would say that the majority of the world's Jews are either secular and or agnostic and or atheistic. They practice their religion as a tradition. So Israel was founded by white Caucasian, mainly Caucasian, white Caucasian, Europeans, Eastern Europeans, and Russians. And they were atheist, socialist, communist Jews. Long story short, so they take Palestine, and this is, long story short, they shout, God gave us this land, shouted the atheist Zionist Jews. So if you don't believe in God, how did God give you the land? Most Christians and Christian Zionists are very unaware of the fact of the large, very large segment of atheism in the Jewish population.
Well, right, the people who created Israel, as you say, were by and large atheists. And some, you know, the real Jews, people like Rabbi Weiss, who's the head of Naturei Karta, the biggest anti-Zionist Orthodox Jewish organization,
I'm a fan of
it, to tell you that these original Zionists were atheists. I think what happened here, PK, is that the a big segment of the Jewish community lost a lot of its religious faith in the 19th century, as did most of the West. Now, there's a great book on this by a guy named A.N. Wilson. It's called God's Funeral, and I highly recommend that as a kind of a primer on how the West lost religion in the 19th century. So these Zionists, I think, were kind of fanatical Jewish tribalists who would have been pretty harmless if they were still religious. In fact, they might have been really good people, because the Jewish religion has different effects on different people, just like any religion does. But, you know, some people, it leads them to try to actually be ethically better than the average person. And if that's what chosen people means, go for it, you know. But the thing was that some of these fanatical Zionists, I think when they lost their religion, they still had a sort of a, you know, burning messianic fervor, and they still had a lot of tribalism where they really identified with other Jews, and they didn't really identify with the Goyim. And so they created this settler colonial state over in Palestine. And PK, here's a little question for you. Just what's your take on why would the British hand over Palestine, the Holy Land, the most symbolically charged real estate on earth? It's been Muslim ever since Islam existed, with just a couple of brief bloody crusader interludes. And obviously, you know, doing anything to it other than keeping it Muslim is going to set off World War III that could last for centuries, if not millennia. Very, very dangerous piece of ground. And the British, you know, already had their hands full trying to administer it. Why would the British hand it over to the Zionists? What was the quid pro quo, in your opinion?
As I am all enlightened, I actually know why. I think I know where you're going with this. Let me back up a little bit. You know, Jews lived in Muslim territories pretty much comfortably for centuries prior to 1900.
That's right.
You know, and if you're talking about why how did Palestine end up in their hands, I should always say by the Rothschild-backed Zionists. The Rothschilds donated the money to the Knesset, too, as I understand it.
Right.
So, I mean, yeah, they put down the Arabs, people. Yeah, look at those, camel jockeys, this and that. Yeah, well, if any other group of people was backed by the Rothschilds, they'd prosper, too.
Well, and there you go. See, the thing is, the British had the world's biggest empire at that time. And
I know, but
it's astounding that this group of Zionists that represents a tiny minority, even within the Jewish population, which is a tiny minority in Europe and an even tinier minority in the world, how could this minority within a minority within a minority manage to coerce the world's greatest empire into giving away this critically important bit of real estate? And, you know, I think the answer suggests that, well, I've even in the mainstream history books, you sometimes run across statements like the British believed that the Rothschilds and their group had the power to give the British victory in World War II, or they believed that they had the money to solve England's problem. Basically, what the textbooks will tell you is that these British guys believed that the Rothschilds and the Zionists had immense money and power. And what those textbooks won't tell you is that, well, the reason they believe that is because the Rothschilds and their friends did and still do have immense money and power. But, of course, we're not allowed to say that.
Well, yes. So to further clarify that, you have the 1916 Sykes-Picot Treaty, then you had the 1917 Balfour Declaration, which gave Palestine to the Zionists. The Zionists who, and this is why Hitler had said the Jews stabbed Germany in the back. Well, I say he was essentially correct, but he should have narrowed it to certain Zionist Jews because, probably know, the bankers, the German Jewish bankers who initially supported Germany because Germany was an allied with Palestine, they thought they could – that way they could get Turkey had that part of the Middle East in their empire. They thought they could get Palestine. When they saw that for all intents and purposes that Germany was winning in 1916 – they contacted the British and said, look, you can still win this war, but you've got to give us Palestine. And we'll bring the U.S. in for you if you promise us this. So that, you know, long story short, that's how this came about. And, of course, before that,
PK, think about the implications of this. All of those how many Americans were killed in World War One? Some, you know, 100,000, a lot of Americans. My grandfather fought in World War One, and it turns out that we were bamboozled into fighting – by the Zionists who owned our media and much of our political system and brainwashed our ancestors, in my case my grandfather, into going off to fight and possibly die purely to create this Rothschild criminal state over in occupied Palestine. It's quite a stunning story. And I think if Americans knew how many Americans have been butchered by these Zionists, I mean, we would be rising up and demanding, well, I can't even really imagine how angry Americans would be.
Well, at this point, I need to remind you, if you don't already know this, Kevin, that, Kevin, I am an American who actually knows world geography and world history. I am an American who actually knows that the rest of the world knows more about America than America knows about the world.
That's right. And I sort of wonder how we became this dumb. I mean, you know, when I was younger, I was in that first generation that had too much, you know, we had drugs in the high school starting to come in. You know, I was in high school from 72 to 76, and the kind of revolution in morality that came in the 60s was having its effects, and some of them were good. You know, there was a lot of interesting thought, a lot of utopianism, and, you know, a lot of good anti-war thought, and all sorts of interesting things were going on. But there was also a downside, which is that, you know, our school system was already basically just a big factory for manufacturing sheep. For taking immigrants and running them through the factory and rubber stamping them red, white, and blue without ever teaching them to think very much. And I think that with that breakdown of discipline that happened with the 60s and early 70s, it became not just mediocre and factory-like, but it really started to fall apart. And you know, as television, of course, has had this powerful effect on several generations now, we've really reached a point where Americans are, you know, the most amazingly stupid people on God's green earth. And if you don't believe that, just Google the wonderful film Americans Are Not Stupid. Have you seen that one?
No, but I'm going to remember to take a look at that. That's great.
Yeah. It's some Australians that made this film. They wandered around the U.S. Asking Americans in public places to identify various parts of the world, and they would take a world map and then mislabel it. So they would say, you know, they would take Australia and write Iran on the island of Australia. And then they would say, well, which country do you think we should invade next? Should it be Iran? And they'd go, yeah, let's invade Iran. And they'd point to Australia, things like that.
I've seen a few of those clips from that. Yeah, that's what the movie's about. Yeah, well, I'm not surprised at all. And I especially realize it when I travel outside of the country. But I believe that the American educational system through the state, they've deliberately dumbed us down, which is why I don't like public schools or state control of education, because it indoctrinates in people into statism and holding up Abraham Lincoln and, FDR as great presidents, for example, and when they were horrific. So thank goodness for objective, intellectual, scholarly revisionism. And I dare to go where others won't probably go. I've read some of your stuff. I'm quite a fan of a lot of David Duke stuff. I like Norman Finkelstein. I like Brother Kapner. I especially like Gilad Atzmon. I've got
I like him too. I actually got to meet him a couple of years ago, and very impressed. That man has a tremendous spirit. You know, he's really an inspired fellow. He really embodies kind of the healthy response to Zionism from within. You know, if you're genuinely healthy person and you grow up in that environment, you know, you pretty much have to do what he did, which is get out and find something else to live for. His music is terrific too. Have you listened to his music?
Yeah, thank goodness he's a musician. I'm a musician too, so I can really relate to that part of things. And so I'm a big fan of his, and I just bought his book, The Wandering Who, and I'm really enjoying reading it. Because I am an American who actually know what books are, sort of. He's interesting. I'm a big fan of his. So I'm a fan of Rabbi David Weiss. So I haven't got to clash with anybody yet on my show. I'm looking forward to the day where someone will call in and I can clash with a Zionist or the very pro-Jewish crowd. Pro-Israel crowd. One thing that I've really, found that when I use this terminology, because it's what you say and how you say it, and I wish Ron, well, I've made a few suggestions to Ron Paul, but he keeps saying we. You should never say we. Generally, you should never say we. You should say, or America. You should say the federal government, because then it puts the blame squarely where it belongs.
Well, I suppose it depends what precisely you're saying, but yeah, overall, if you're talking war, I guess I would have to agree with that.
Kevin, war, foreign aid,
yeah,
drone attacks, the drug war, that's TSA, that's all the federal government. The federal government, to me, is the enemy, and it's about 95% beyond what it should be doing. And Occupy Wall Street should be occupying Washington, D.C., and the Federal Reserve and the DEA and these other places. That's where the problem comes from. I'm not
I don't know, PK. I think it's both. You know, I know it's certainly ironic that the left, which normally critiques private power, is completely out to lunch on the immense private power of the money masters, the Federal Reserve, the Rothschild people. And the right, which normally critiques government power, as you're doing now, is more accurate in its understanding of the immense power of the private bankers. But I think we have to look at both. You know, one of my favorite sort of anarchist textbook, one of my introductions to anarchism, was a book from way back when. I think it's called In Defense of Anarchism by Wolf, maybe. And this professor, I think his name is Wolf, it's been a long time, points out that philosophically anarchism has a very strong point in stating that we should not just automatically elevate a bureaucracy that calls itself the government and imagine that it somehow is has any kind of extra credibility or authority or legitimacy to do anything as opposed to any other bureaucracy. So that's a great place to start. But once you're thinking that way, okay, so you see, you know, there's some guy dressed up in a uniform that, you know, goes and busts a speeder or a criminal or whatever, you shouldn't just automatically say, oh, well, you know, he's working for the government, he's got a uniform on, that's what he's doing is legitimate no matter what it is. No, quite the opposite. Instead, you'd say, well, here's a guy and he's, you know, keeping society safe from speeders or criminals, and if he didn't do it, somebody else would have to, yada, yada, yada. So it's probably okay. It's a good thing to do these things. But likewise, if somebody without a uniform also keeps society safe from some threat, that's good, too. And so basically, we shouldn't be prejudging what groups and individuals and bureaucracies do based on whether they're called a government or not. In other words, what a government is, it's just a mafia that has convinced people that it has a monopoly of force in a given territory. Now, it just so happens that we're probably better off having a mafia with a monopoly of force or something close to it in whatever territory we're living in, because if not, it's going to devolve into gang warfare. So it's probably okay, but still, you shouldn't be thinking of this mafia as anything other than just another mafia, and you should judge it by its fruits. That is, does it keep peace well? Does it dispense justice? Does it help dispense prosperity? And if we think that way, I think we're in a better position to critique both private power and public power on the same plane. And right now, in today's world, I actually think that private power, in a way, is really even more out of control than public power. That is, it's these private bankers that really call the shots, and these private power sources have become so outrageous in their criminality. They've corrupted people who have, you know, who are supposed to be working for the mafia, the red, white, and blue mafia, you know, the one that calls itself the legitimate government. But these criminal mobs, these private power mobs, whether they're based on coining the money, whether they're based on dealing drugs and laundering money or selling black market stuff, whatever, there's so much really deeply corrupt and greedy and self-centered private power out there that has swamped what's left of public power, that I actually think that the leftists have something in, you know, that they have a point when they say that we need to get control of these wealthy private power sources. People like Tarpley, who idolizes Franklin D. Roosevelt, says we need a president now who could actually bust these bankers and bust these criminals who did 9/11. I mean, it wasn't the U.S. government as a government that did 9/11. It was a criminal network with its headquarters in Israel, but it's a criminal network that doesn't answer to any public power anywhere.
Well, let me put my clarification on what you've just said. Now, if you're talking about law and order, I do have very preconceived notions about. I'm very judgmental about government. I hate most government. The federal government, I can't stand it. I am preconceived about this. I'll address the private thing too. But as far as law and order, police and courts, decentralization, keep an order, yes, I'm all for that. But I'm totally opposed to the federal mafia. The federal mafia, DEA, EPA, CIA, all these agencies, these alphabet soup agencies, that's the federal mafia, and they cooperate with the global mafia, the UN, the IMF, the World Bank, NAFTA, WTO, all these organizations. Now, as far as private power, that's derived, that comes from government power and government force. I'm a staunch advocate of free market capitalism and the free enterprise system, but I am disgusted by the perversion of capitalism by crony capitalism, tax-funded bailouts, corporate welfare.
Let me just ask you something then about, for instance, you know, in the parts of the world where there isn't much of quote-unquote government, which again just means a mafia that's able to project itself as a legitimate government by means of a monopoly of force in the territory. So in places in the world where there isn't anything like that, and there are some places, I have my PhD from an African department, even though I studied North Africa and Arab stuff and Islamic stuff, there are parts of Africa where you can go and there's essentially no public government. It's all just private cartels fighting each other. Likewise, the former Soviet Union lost, I think men lost, 15 years plus of life expectancy when their very powerful government fell apart, leaving essentially no government and nothing but these private cartels fighting with each other. And I think if you actually had to go and live in one of these places without any mafia that has the ability to project itself as a legitimate authority with a monopoly of force in the territory, you might actually want to come running back to territory that's got one of those governmental mafias.
No, I don't mind. I don't mind small, limited government, but I'm against big government gives bailouts and corporate welfare and subsidies and crony capitalism. I'm opposed to all that. But the people tend to blame the bankers. However, the bankers are all tied into the Federal Reserve System. So yes, the bankers did some bad things, but they got their enabling from the Federal Reserve by lowering the interest rates. And of course, they're very Zionist. They're tied, Greenspan, Bernanke, most of Wall Street. So a lot of these so-called anti-Semitic people out there on Wall Street, they're not too far from the mark on a lot of things that they criticize.
Well, there's probably some truth to that. But getting back to that public power, private power issue, I think that it's more complex than sort of a straightforward libertarianism of the kind that you sound like you're espousing really can do justice to, in my humble opinion. I mean, I've been thinking these things through from various perspectives for a while, and I have my own idiosyncratic take on all of this. But I think that I got into the Libertarian Party a few years ago, and so I got to know people who are much more card-carrying in their libertarianism than me. And I think there's an element of being a little too rigorous in applying an ideology that makes a lot of sense as an ideology, but for various reasons in the world as we have it, it may not work so well. I'm a Muslim too, and my fellow Muslims often have the same problem because we have this, we imagine we have this wonderful system that would work so perfectly if it were ever really applied. And it's just so easy to start to fall for a rigorous ideology that sounds so good in the abstract, but you start applying it. And, for instance, when the Chicago boys started applying their relatively libertarian approach to places like Chile, the result, as Naomi Klein points out with some justification, was not always improving matters.
Well, I was opposed to the CIA overthrowing Allende, but they did improve the economy, even though I'm not a fan of Milton Friedman's. But let me clarify something. You just talked about this public-private thing and rigid ideology. Let me just throw this out to you then to show you where I'm coming from. Hopefully this will win you over. Kevin, let's say that, for the sake of argument, let's say that McDonnell Douglas manufactures drones. These terrible new weapons.
I'm afraid they actually do.
Okay. Well, let's just say they do, okay? Okay, can McDonnell Douglas launch a drone attack against other countries?
That's a very good question.
And they can't. They only do it through the
federal. I don't think you can say that. I mean, they.
Wait.
Sense.
They cannot do it. The federal government takes them and launches them. They're the ones who do it. They're the ones who take our taxes to pay for it. So the private sector alone can't do it. General Motors can't send you a tax bill. But government can take you and throw you in jail. General Motors can't do that. Let's say somebody else who makes cluster bombs could. Let's say Raytheon, for example, makes cluster bombs. Could Raytheon go over and drop cluster bombs on innocent Palestinians in Gaza. No, governments do that. So that's where I make a very clear distinction. It's a government monopoly of force. When they do it, it's fine. You know, so the private sector, they don't do those sort of things.
Well, I think you're right up to a point.
They're contracted by the state.
Right. You're right up to a point. But in the real world, of course, what happens is that if Raytheon and General Dynamics, General Electric, and all of these corporations decide that they want to drop bombs on Afghanistan, and perhaps there would be some other companies as well in on that kind of decision, then what they do is they pool their money and they make sure that they get the people in the White House that they want, and then the deal is done. And so who is it who actually chose to bomb Afghanistan? It certainly wasn't the average of the Americans who voted, and it really wasn't, you know, it wasn't even really the president and the National Security Council, because what really happened in the actual world was that these private power people gave the order, okay, we're going to have that war, and they made it happen. And that's why I think private power has too much power. If we actually had public power a little stronger, then ordinary people's vote would have an influence on who was in the White House, and I think we would see a lot less of these decisions to bomb foreign lands.
I want just the opposite. I want a tremendous weakening of government power, because that government in power includes funding the military-industrial complex. And you just proved my point. You said these companies decided they want this kind of war there and there, and they got the occupant of the White House to do it. Well, it has to come from the power structure. It has to come from government. McDonnell Douglas cannot declare war on Iran. It has to come from the source, and that's the federal government. That's, to me, that's where that comes from. Now, I wanted to move on a little bit and talk about 9/11. I'm pretty convinced that Mossad's fingerprints are all over this thing.
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
And I think there might have been a small rogue element of CIA involved. Of course, as I'm fond of saying, CIA, MI6, and Mossad are masters of deception, and they work together.
Right.
So, and then, of course, you have to look at who this benefited. I think it greatly benefited Israel in the further demonization of Islam and Muslims, because Israel wants a greater Israel. And so they pulled this off, the Mossad, and they've turned the whole world, you know, against Islam. Islam's under the gun for a lot of this stuff. But as I'm fond of saying in my humble yet all-knowing opinion, America had no enemies in the Middle East prior to 1948, when Israel was violently imposed on Palestine. And ever since then, this has been a big problem. And this is how I also like to argue this, debate this with my fellow Americans. And feel free to use this brilliant intellectual information here, Kevin.
Well, I can't really disagree with any of that.
Well, nor should you.
The one thing the caveat, though, would be that I don't think that, I mean, you could say Mossad did 9/11 if you're going to assume that, you know, Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Myers and the many other U.S. officials who participated in the 9/11 false flag event did so purely as agents of the Mossad. And I'm not sure it's quite that simple, but
I think
that it's a generalization, that statement holds. The main player, I think, had to have been Mossad. And the main reason, the motive, had to have been this Zionist war on the Middle East, which is really the only way the state of Israel can exist.
I think that Bush was out of the loop, though. I think Cheney, with his NORAD stand-down, was involved. And as far as the others, they just were glad to have this little war so they could, you know, continue to prosecute it. That's how I see it. But this debating point I wanted to give you is, this is something I'm fond of saying. I've had these debates on internet and elsewhere, and nobody, I've really disarmed hardcore pro-war conservatives on this too, because, and here I go, because I'm fond to quote myself, nowhere in the U.S. Constitution are American taxpayers required to continuously support Israel with foreign aid and to give them an endless supply of free American-made murder weapons. Israel is not our 51st state. And see, they can argue, they can't deny it. And plus, Plus, I would also say, and this goes back to government, Kevin, not private. Private is involved, of course, but government. The federal government has over 900 military bases in over 140 foreign countries. That is the main problem. That's why they're pissed off. They don't want us there. They don't want us occupying their countries. They don't want us interfering, and I completely get that. You know, and I also like to say that, you know, World War II has been over for what, 66 years or 65 years. Korean War has been over for 58 years. Why are we still defending our rich allies of Western Europe, England, South Korea, Japan, you know, who then hammer us on trade? It's ridiculous.
Well, I agree completely.
You should.
You know, there's a wide spectrum of opinion that understands this. I was recently reading the new book by Pat Buchanan, which I hope to have him on my show at some point. Interesting guy, and he, you know, he makes this point from just a plain old realistic perspective that for the sake of the U.S. and its people, and to the extent there's still a kind of collective national interest that unites Americans, that it's just utterly and completely insane to be running this gigantic military empire. And as you say, I think that the Zionists have really become the biggest force for militarism. And this was planned, I think, a while back. It was pretty clear that once communism was gone as the enemy justifying this military-industrial state, that they would bring in the Muslims as the next big enemy. And they really fabricated that. The U.S. was actually the ally of the Islamic world, including its relatively militant elements, in bringing down the former Soviet Union. And so geostrategically, actually, it's been the so-called Al-Qaeda, which is really not a united organization. It's just a whole bunch of kind of separate mercenaries and drug smugglers and you know, jihadi heroes who are willing to go fight for Islam wherever. That whole group of people was actually fighting on behalf of the U.S., not only in Afghanistan against the Russians, but after that, right up through 9/11, and even now, those people are fighting on the U.S. side in most conflicts because, of course, they have more beefs with the Russians than with us. And so in a sane world, PK, the U.S. would actually be the ally of the Islamic world. We would want the Islamic world to become stronger and more united, and we would be basically making a deal for, you know, as first preference customers for their oil and gas in return for offering them a certain amount of protection. That is, they wouldn't have to build as big of a military because, we would use our military power, which even if we cut ours by 90%, would still be probably the biggest on the planet. So there's no reason why we shouldn't have essentially a sort of, energy for stability relationship going with our closest allies in the world being a united Islamic caliphate, run by fairly hardcore, political Islamic people. And that would be to our advantage because our main rivals are Russia, China, and India. We're competing with all of those countries in various ways, with China and India in particular, for raw material imports, especially energy imports, and for a manufacturing base. But what's happened, of course, is that the financial sector, which does include it, it's really dominated probably by these Zionists, has chosen to export and basically destroy America's productive capacity in all of our industries and allow China and India to rise, and they've become our big competitors. And now they've turned us against the Islamic world, which should be our ally. And, the U.S. could still be a very, very prosperous and peaceful nation for a very long time and be the most powerful nation in the world for a very long time were we to be allies with the Islamic, a much strengthened Islamic world and have first customer benefit on their oil and gas. But instead, the Zionists have led us into a suicidal war against the Islamic world, which is allowing our genuine rivals to rise. And China will have a bigger economy than the U.S. within just a few years. And it won't be very much longer before they have military superiority as well. And at that point, somehow I don't think that we are going to keep importing vast amounts of consumer goods from China that we're going to pay for with green toilet paper for much longer. So you can see, expect the U.S. economy to just completely collapse, U.S. power to completely collapse. The empire is about to go into free fall. And the reason is this treasonous behavior by the Zionists who are using U.S. military to try to wipe out the enemies of Israel, who are really the allies of the U.S.
Well, as far as China, this is China's century. You know, I don't. I'm not worried about China or India or Russia. Actually, I don't see why America has to be has to have first choice in natural resources. Whoever wants to buy them in a friendly.
Well, again, I'll tell you why. Let me just explain that. It's because that we're consuming a vastly exorbitant chunk of the world's resources, especially energy resources, right now. And yes, we need to get weaned from that, but it's going to take time. And so we need to get weaned gently.
Well, I don't know about getting weaned. I don't see why we just can't do business. You know, why does it have to be, why do guns have to follow trade when it comes to oil? This is China's century. The 20th century was America's. The 19th century was Britain's. And there's other reasons. I mean, I believe that American business is heavily overregulated, heavily overtaxed. You have American labor unions who have been able to force above market wages on American employers over the decades. And now these chickens have come home to roost. So there's, you know, there's other reasons why this stuff is happening. Plus, the military industrial complex continues to suck up billions and billions of important investment dollars for private sector development. So, you know, there's this whole thing is out of kilter. It's you know, it's not in terms of how it should be. And I'm a very pro Ron Paul supporter, as I worked on his 1988 campaign. So you know, to me, he's the only guy who's going to fix this mess, because
everybody else, they're
all pro war, they're all neocons, and it's just, you know, it's just worse. Obama is Bush 3, you know, and Obama's clueless about the economy.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think that the decision makers these days are, the power has gone into the hands of various bankers and industrialists, but mainly the bankers, you know, the financial people. And those people are going to make their money whether the manufacturing is here or in China. But, you know, PK, I don't really agree with your libertarian economics. And I agree with it as a kind of an ideal to aspire for. But in the real world as it is today, there's no such thing as a free market. And because the U.S. has chosen to act as though there were a free market, and we were getting slaughtered. You know, we don't make anything anymore. And back in 1990, we were the world's leading industrial powerhouse. Now, you can blame the labor unions all you want, but I don't see why we shouldn't be perfectly happy to have our people have a huge middle class, have a lot of manufacturing jobs, have people making good wages in manufacturing, which is going to happen if you have the unions, and then we should be just as economically nationalistic as the next guy. And in fact, the financiers chose it to push through this free trade, which has destroyed our unions and destroyed our working class and our middle class and destroyed our base in industrial productivity. There is, as you know, Pat Buchanan is right here, you know, this country is committing suicide, you know, that's the title of his book.
I'm for a healthy middle class manufacturing base. But it's just, I understand that there's reasons that they've been driven out by the taxation, the overregulation, all this sort of stuff. I mean, I see it even locally with overbearing government on different things. So there's a lot of things that are part of this problem.
Though, aren't you going to get a race to the bottom where the kind of discrepancies in wealth that we see in the third world will be our lot as well? Is that what we really want here?
No, but you have to look. The central state has caused this problem. Look at the federal government again. Although they say the Fed is separate, the Fed has caused this whole mess. They caused the recession, depression, just as the Fed caused the Great Depression. And in 1933, when America went off the gold standard, hundreds of economists shouted, "Don't do it." I mean, it's not the perfect system, but, you know, this inflation has eroded the middle class, their purchasing power, and also people on fixed incomes and the poor. It hurts them the most. So the government controls the money supply. They destroy the value of the money. They control the central bank, which all the other banks are tied into. And then the Fed bails out these foreign banks and these foreign institutions. Hell yes, they should be audited big time. So, you know, I always blame the central state for a lot of this problem.
But if you look at history, it bears it out in somewhat. You know, there are, of course, examples where the conventional wisdom is probably wrong in the direction that you would agree with. That is, you know, this notion that, for example, World War II pulled the U.S. out of the Great Depression, which isn't true. It actually slowed the recovery from the Great Depression.
Exactly.
But if you look at the history of various countries industrializing and becoming wealthy, in most cases, it isn't that they haven't had any kind of big government. It's generally the opposite. For example, you know, one of the biggest economic miracles of the 20th century were, number one, Germany's recovery from being a complete basket case in the 1920s to being the industrial powerhouse of Europe by 1936. You know, Hitler was in power for just a couple of years and turned that country around. How? By printing government money, chasing the bankers out, and having an industrial policy. Likewise, that's exactly what the Germans were able to do after World War II and to create yet another economic miracle. And it's what the Japanese were able to do to rapidly industrialize their country and become one of the wealthiest countries in the world in our age. Likewise, if you look at the U.S. economy, after World War II, we experienced boom times right up through about 1970. And part of that was because all of our competitors had been flattened. But it was also a time when the top marginal rates on income, if I'm not mistaken, in the 50s got close to 90%, which is what they've been also in other Western democracies that became somewhat socialistic. We did have various kinds of industrial planning by the government. And today, we're losing out to countries like Germany and Japan and especially China, which do have very strong central government direction over their economic policy. They figure out where they can have a competitive advantage internationally. They encourage that. They have disguised tariffs, you know, by other means, as China has by devaluing its currency. So for all of these reasons, I think that in the real world, if we still are in a world of nation states, and if a nation state wants to prosper, it cannot simply declare an absolute free market and open its borders to free trade. It will just be robbed blind. And that's what's happening to the ordinary American people. And those robbing us blind are financiers with no loyalty to this country and, in many cases, not even residents in this country.
Well, I would say that America was successful in the 50s and whatnot in spite of the ridiculously high tax rates. And Japan and Western Germany were, of course, propped up and built up with American aid after the war, so their factories are newer than ours. You know, there's other reasons why this happened. America is successful basically for two essential basic reasons, where we start out with smaller taxes and small government, which allow this creative outpouring. Then you have this huge regulatory apparatus that's taken its place. And a lot of the regulatory agencies historically were supported by Republicans who staffed these agencies with their own people, because with their armies of lawyers and accountants, big business can weather the changes in all the taxes and the regulations more easily than smaller business or competitors, which they use regulation to keep them out. So this is what I've learned, you know, through my study of economics.
So again, yes, it depends on the wisdom of the policies. You can have policies that are essentially corrupt, you know, for the benefit of the few and against the interest of the many. Or you can have policies that are less corrupt. But it's interesting that typically, you know, a nation functions sort of like a corporation. It is just another bureaucracy, after all, as are corporations. And just as corporations often will strive to perpetuate themselves and maximize their power and their relative power, nations do that too, because the people that rise to the top are really steeped in that ethos. And for that reason, again, nations with these industrial policies that are designed to promote the growth of the nation as such are going to beat out those nations that don't have such policies.
Well, yeah, but it's true to an extent. Of course, I'm opposed to protectionism because it makes us pay higher prices and it makes us less competitive. I don't want to give protectionism some economic dinosaur when there's other, you know, more efficient things created elsewhere. And China's our biggest banker. We're, you know, Bush put the war on a credit card to China. So how dare us, you know, threaten China or rattle China? You know, they're doing what they got to do. Part of the reason in Libya they kicked out like 80,000 Chinese who were there. I mean, you know, the U.S. is trying to kick China out of other places, and you know, China's like Ron Paul said, they're making deals peacefully. They're going here, they're going there, they're making deals. They don't bring in their military with them. You know, this is a communist government acting more capitalistically than American's government in a way. What's it going to take? A Marxist U.S. government to impose a free market economy on the country? They say it's easier to start a business in China nowadays. I mean, China's one of its biggest problems, of course, is pollution, and their one-child policy is going to throw a serious wrench in the gears, and they're going to have their own problems too. But I'm hesitant to gang up on China because you know, it's much better for the Chinese people now than it ever was before, too. I mean,
right.
You know,
part of that, the reason for that, PK, is that the Chinese government has a nationalized currency and banking system, and they create money and then they lend it into existence at interest, or rather, you know, not necessarily with interest. In some cases, they hand it out to favored industries because they have this very well thought out industrial policy. They figure out where can they compete with the world, and that's where they put their money because their government runs their central bank. And Japan has done well with the same situation. You know, their postal bank is the biggest government-run central bank in the world, and the Rothschild private bankster cartel has been drooling to get at that one forever. And in fact, you know, I've had Ellen Brown, a currency reformer, on my radio show talking about this, and she's no conspiracy theorist, but boy, she is disturbed by the fact that the Prime Minister of Japan stated in last December that he had been threatened with an earthquake weapon if Japan did not privatize its postal bank, the world's biggest government-run bank. And just a few months later, Fukushima hit. So,
talking about that HARP technology?
Right,
possibly?
Right. And
yeah,
so these are private banksters. They're the ones who create the money out of nothing. They run the Federal Reserve. It's not federal, and there are no reserves. It's a private Rothschild and Friends banking cartel. And if you privatize the earth, they're the ones who are going to end up running it. And there will be less accountability. They'll just hire goons instead of, you know, government goons. You'll have
already
private goons. You'll have Blackwater goons, or even worse. I'm kind of stressing this non-libertarian element of my
thinking.
Just as to be a devil's advocate with you, but I do think there's something to it.
They're already running it, and Blackwater and all those government contractors are feeding off the tax trough. That's not free enterprise.
But are they better off if they're, rather than taking tax money, if they're taking money directly from wealthy private interests, as is the case in Russia? The Russian mob, you know, has run the show since the destruction of communism. And yeah, sure, it was wonderful to see the end of communism and that incredibly powerful government bureaucracy, but it wasn't wonderful for most of the Russian people. They lost 15 years of life expectancy. That country is getting flushed down the toilet of history, and it's run by totally private cartels that have as much violence as they need. They're constantly fighting it out. You know,
exactly.
The equivalent of a cop in Russia, in many parts of Russia, is a gangster. And is that really better to have that kind of private security system than the kind of public security system you have in a country with a fairly strong and stable government?
But that Russia's transition after communism was very statist. It rewarded former communists and, you know, bureaucrats. It was not a free market thing at all. And it's very corrupt. And there's a very large Jewish mafia contingency in Russia. What was that point I was going to make? It was something you had said. I forget what it was.
I was talking about the central banks being a very important part of the success of China.
Oh, yeah, I know. Sorry. Kevin, Japan's been in a slump since 1990. You know, these stimulus packages, they don't work. They're not a permanent source of production and, longevity. So we agree on a heck of a lot more than we disagree on, Kevin. But
right. Ron Paul, that's for sure. But
of course.
My problem, though, here, PK, is I'm afraid that if Ron Paul were to win, which would be great, the problem here is that it could become another, you know, problem-reaction-solution thing in which he's set up to fail. You know, in a sense, Obama may be a peace candidate set up to fail precisely as a peace candidate so that we will never again, you know, want peace or vote for a peace candidate. And likewise, Ron Paul could be set up to fail as a libertarian, because if he were to actually carry through rigorously libertarian economic policies, well, Tarpley may be exaggerating when he says that it would be genocide, but I'm not sure if he's exaggerating all that much. I think it would be catastrophic, and people would respond by being scared off of libertarianism for centuries.
Well, I was really disappointed to see, I saw recently that Tarpster was very pro-FDR. I couldn't believe his reasoning on that. So I totally disagree with him about economics, but he was good about 9/11 and the Obama deception and whatnot. But Obama was groomed by the globalists. Brzezinski, you know, Ron Paul, like myself, we cannot be bought. We speak truth to power. So my worry was that Ron Paul would be suicided or, you know, assassinated. Of course, that would make him a martyr. So I'm going to continue supporting him and going down that path, because he's the only one that has integrity of the whole bunch. The other ones are all, especially Bachman, Gingrich, they're Perry, all of them, they're heavily indebted to the Jewish lobby, Israeli lobby. Herman Cain, my Israelite policy is, my policy with Israel is, you mess with Israel, you mess with me. I mean, they're not our 51st state, you know, so, but anyway,
yeah,
listen,
I agree.
Kevin,
you know, Ron Paul is definitely the best of a very bad lot. In fact, he's even pretty good, so he stands out head and shoulders above the rest. And I do think that if he were elected and he were able to fulfill his pledge to end the empire peacefully by bringing all the troops home from everywhere, closing all the military bases abroad, that in itself would, it would be a big shock to the economy at first. But it's going to have to happen one way or another, and it would be better that it would happen that way than through various other ways.
And a president can do that. Hey, Kevin, by the way, I'm pretty smart for an American, aren't I?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, you're obviously paying attention. How old are you, by the way?
I am 56 going on 40.
Well, and that's
Kevin,
pretty much where I am, too.
Kevin, the older I get, the better I was.
Okay, yeah. I'm always kind of curious, like, about, you know, how many young people are paying attention. It seems like the young people who are really paying attention these days are, a lot of them are trending, you know, Ron Paul libertarian.
Of course, yeah. Of course, because they know they're slammed with all this debt. Listen, Kevin, I got to wind down now. Listen, thank you so much for coming on. I'd like to have you back because you're an exciting guest. You know what you're talking about. I will continue to enlighten you about economics. You should. We pretty much agree on foreign policy, and you know that I ain't going to demonize Islam or wet my pants and go, ask you why you hate America. I can do. Here's my Sean Hannity impression. Oh, Kevin, why do you hate America? Tell me. Why do you hate America? Sean.
Yeah,
Sean.
That's just about it. You can actually Google my name and Sean Hannity's if you want to actually see the real thing.
Sean, you not only have a stick up your butt, Sean, but you're so full of apple pie and Chevrolet that you can't think straight.
And that's
thank you. I wrote that. Well, listen, Kevin, I'm going to sign off now and say goodbye, but thank you very much. And
hey,
I want to have you back soon.
It's very stimulating. You're a great interview. Maybe I'll have you on my show sometime.
Thank you. And I would like to be on your show, and I'm going to invite you back soon because you're the kind of guest I like to have. So with that, I am going to wind down here and say thank you for listening, my growing multitude of millions, I wish. This is your host, PK, signing off. Now, I'm here every Monday evening at 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, and 11:55 Eastern. And with that, I'm saying good night. Take care. Please check in next week. Same time, same place. BBSradio.com. Good night, everyone.